Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
This is an announcement to all United States vehicle owners who own a 2003 or newer vehicle with a manufacturer's warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all. With a struggling economy and the cost of living on the rise, Endurance is now offering an affordable, low-cost vehicle coverage plan to the general public. As of today, you could be one of millions of drivers that now may qualify to have your vehicle protected under this coverage and have all future covered auto repairs paid directly to the repair shop for you. You pick your plan, you pick your deductible, you even pick the repair shop. Roadside service, towing, and rental coverage is included. To all United States vehicle owners who own a 2003 or newer vehicle with a manufacturer's warranty about to expire, get your vehicle protected now and save your wallet from costly vehicle repairs. For your free 5-minute quote and to see if you qualify, visit endurancewarranty.com. Endurancewarranty.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Chekris, London, UK. The Triumphs of Eugene Valmont by Robert Barr. Chapter 4. Lord Chizelrigg's Missing Fortune. The name of the late Lord Chizelrigg never comes to my mind without instantly suggesting that of Mr. T. A. Edison. I never saw the late Lord Chizelrigg, and I have met Mr. Edison only twice in my life. Yet the two men are linked in my memory, and it was a remark the latter once made that in great measure enabled me to solve the mystery which the former had wrapped round his actions. There is no memorandum at hand to tell me the year in which those two meetings with Edison took place. I received a note from the Italian ambassador in Paris requesting me to wait upon him at the embassy. I learned that on the next day a deputation was to set out from the embassy to one of the chief hotels, there to make a call in state upon the great American inventor, and formally present to him various insignia accompanying certain honours which the King of Italy had conferred upon him. As many Italian nobles of high rank had been invited, and as these dignitaries would not only be robed in the costumes pertaining to their orders, but in many cases would wear jewels of almost inestimable value, my presence was desired in the belief that I might perhaps be able to ward off any attempt on the part of the deft-handed gentry, who might possibly make an effort to gain these treasures. And, I may add, with perhaps some little self-gratification, no contretemps occurred. Mr. Edison, of course, had long before received notification of the hour at which the deputation would wait upon him, but when we entered the large parlour assigned to the inventor, it was evident to me at a glance that the celebrated man had forgotten all about the function. He stood by a bare table, from which the cloth had been jerked and flung into a corner, and upon that table were placed several bits of black and greasy machinery, cog-wheels, pulleys, bolts, etc. These seemingly belonged to a French workman who stood on the other side of the table with one of the parts in his grimy hand. Edison's own hands were not too clean, for he had palpably been examining the material and conversing with the workman, who wore the ordinary long blouse of an iron craftsman in a small way. I judged him to be a man with a little shop of his own in some back street, who did odd jobs of engineering, assisted perhaps by a skilled helper or two, and a few apprentices. Edison looked sternly toward the door as the solemn procession filed in, and there was a trace of annoyance on his face at the interruption, mixed with a shade of perplexity as to what this gorgeous display all meant. The Italian is as ceremonious as the Spaniard where a function is concerned, and the official who held the ornate box which contained the jewellery resting on a velvet cushion stepped slowly forward, and came to a stand in front of the bewildered American. Then the ambassador, in sonorous voice, spoke some gracious words regarding the friendship existing between the United States and Italy, expressed a wish that their rivalry should ever take the form of benefits conferred upon the human race, and instanced the honoured recipient as the most notable example the world has yet produced of a man bestowing blessings upon all nations in the arts of peace. The eloquent ambassador concluded by saying that, at the command of his royal master, it was both his duty and his pleasure to present, and so forth. Mr. Edison, visibly ill at ease, nevertheless made a suitable reply in the fewest possible words, and the étalage being thus at an end, the noblemen, headed by their ambassador, slowly retired, myself forming the tail of the procession. Inwardly, I deeply sympathised with the French workman, who thus unexpectedly found himself confronted by so much magnificence. He cast one wild look about him, but saw that his retreat was cut off unless he displaced some of these gorgeous grandees. He tried then to shrink into himself, and finally stood helpless like one paralysed. In spite of republican institutions, there is deep down in every Frenchman's heart a respect and awe for official pageants, sumptuously staged and costumed as this one was. But he likes to view it from afar, and supported by his fellows, not thrust incongruously into the midst of things, as was the case with this panic-stricken engineer. As I passed out, I cast a glance over my shoulder at the humble artisan, content with a profit of a few francs a day, and at the millionaire inventor opposite him. Edison's face, which during the address had been cold and impassive, reminding me vividly of a bust of Napoleon, was all now aglow with enthusiasm as he turned to his humble visitor. He cried joyfully to the workman, "A minute's demonstration is worth an hour's explanation. I'll call round tomorrow at your shop about 10 o'clock and show you how to make the thing work." I lingered in the hall until the Frenchman came out, then, introducing myself to him, asked the privilege of visiting his shop next day at 10. This was accorded with that courtesy which you will always find among the industrial classes of France, and next day I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Edison. During our conversation, I complimented him on his invention of the incandescent electric light, and this was the reply that has ever remained in my memory. "It was not an invention, but a discovery. We knew what we wanted, a carbonized tissue which would withstand the electric current in a vacuum for, say, 1,000 hours. If no such tissue existed, then the incandescent light as we know it was not possible. My assistants started out to find this tissue, and we simply carbonized everything we could lay our hands on, and ran the current through it in a vacuum. At last we struck the right thing, as we were bound to do if we kept on long enough, and if the thing existed. Patience and hard work will overcome any obstacle." This belief has been of great assistance to me in my profession. I know the idea is prevalent that a detective arrives at his solutions in a dramatic way, through following clues invisible to the ordinary man. This doubtless frequently happens, but as a general thing, the patience and hard work which Mr. Edison commends is a much safer guide. Very often the following of excellent clues has led me to disaster, as was the case with my unfortunate attempt to solve the mystery of the 500 diamonds. As I was saying, I never think of the late Lord Chizelrigg without remembering Mr. Edison at the same time, and yet the two were very dissimilar. I suppose Lord Chizelrigg was the most useless man that ever lived, while Edison is the opposite. One day my servant brought in to me a card on which was engraved, "Lord Chizelrigg." "Show his lordship in," I said, and there appeared a young man of perhaps 24 or 25, well-dressed and of most charming manners, who nevertheless began his interview by asking a question such as had never before been addressed to me, and which, if put to a solicitor or other professional man, would have been answered with some indignation. Indeed, I believe it is a written or unwritten law of the legal profession that the acceptance of such a proposal as Lord Chizelrigg made to me would, if proved, result in the disgrace and ruin of the lawyer. "Monsieur Valmont," began Lord Chizelrigg, "do you ever take up cases on speculation?" "On speculation, sir? I do not think I understand you." His lordship blushed like a girl, and stammered slightly as he attempted an explanation. "What I mean is, do you accept a case on a contingent fee? That is to say, monsieur, well, not to put too fine a point upon it, no results, no pay." I replied, somewhat severely, "Such an offer has never been made to me, and I may say at once that I should be compelled to decline it were I favoured with the opportunity. In the cases submitted to me, I devote my time and attention to their solution. I try to deserve success, but I cannot command it, and as in the interim I must live, I am reluctantly compelled to make a charge for my time, at least. I believe the doctor sends in his bill, though the patient dies." The young man laughed uneasily, and seemed almost too embarrassed to proceed, but finally he said, "Your illustration strikes home with greater accuracy than probably you imagined when you uttered it. I have just paid my last penny to the physician who attended my late uncle, Lord Chizelrigg, who died 6 months ago. I am fully aware that the suggestion I made may seem like a reflection upon your skill, or rather as implying a doubt regarding it, but I should be grieved, monsieur, if you fell into such an error. I could have come here and commissioned you to undertake some elucidation of the strange situation in which I find myself, and I make no doubt you would have accepted the task if your numerous engagements had permitted. Then, if you failed, I should have been unable to pay you, for I am practically bankrupt. My whole desire, therefore, was to make an honest beginning, and to let you know exactly how I stand. If you succeed, I shall be a rich man. If you do not succeed, I shall be what I am now, penniless. Have I made it plain now why I began with a question which you had every right to resent?" "Perfectly plain, my lord, and your candour does you credit." I was very much taken with the unassuming manners of the young man, and his evident desire to accept no service under false pretences. When I had finished my sentence, the pauper nobleman rose to his feet and bowed. "I am very much your debtor, monsieur, for your courtesy in receiving me, and can only beg pardon for occupying your time on a futile quest. I wish you good morning, monsieur." "One moment, my lord," I rejoined, waving him to his chair again. "Although I am unprepared to accept a commission on the terms you suggest, I may, nevertheless, be able to offer a hint or two that will prove of service to you. I think I remember the announcement of Lord Chizelrigg's death. He was somewhat eccentric, was he not?"
"Eccentric," said the young man with a slight laugh, seating himself again. "Well, rather. I vaguely remember that he was accredited with the possession of something like 20,000 acres of land."
27,000, as a matter of fact," replied my visitor. "Have you fallen heir to the lands as well as to the title?"
"Oh yes, the estate was entailed. The old gentleman could not divert it from me if he would, and I rather suspect that fact must have been the cause of some worry to him."
"But surely, my lord, a man who owns, as one might say, a principality in this wealthy realm of England cannot be penniless." Again the young man laughed. "Well, no," he replied, thrusting his hand in his pocket and bringing to light a few brown coppers and a white silver piece. "I possess enough money to buy some food tonight, but not enough to dine at the Hotel Cecil. You see, it is like this. I belong to a somewhat ancient family, various members of whom went the pace and mortgaged their acres up to the hilt. I could not raise a further penny on my estates were I to try my hardest, because at the time the money was lent, land was much more valuable than it is today. Agricultural depression and all that sort of thing have, if I may put it so, left me a good many thousands worse off than if I had no land at all. Besides this, during my late uncle's life, Parliament on his behalf intervened once or twice, allowing him in the first place to cut valuable timber, and in the second place to sell the pictures of Chizelrigg Chase at Christie's for figures which make one's mouth water. "And what became of the money?" I asked, whereupon once more this genial nobleman laughed. "That is exactly what I came up in the lift to learn if Monsieur Valmont could discover." "My lord, you interest me," I said, quite truly, with an uneasy apprehension that I should take up his case after all, for I liked the young man already. His lack of pretence appealed to me, and that sympathy which is so universal among my countrymen enveloped him, as I may say, quite independent of my own will. "My uncle," went on Lord Chizelrigg, "was somewhat of an anomaly in our family. He must have been a reversal to a very, very ancient type, a type of which we have no record. He was as miserly as his forefathers were prodigal. When he came into the title and estate some 20 years ago, he dismissed the whole retinue of servants, and, indeed, was defendant in several cases at law where retainers of our family brought suit against him for wrongful dismissal, or dismissal without a penny compensation in lieu of notice. I am pleased to say he lost all his cases, and when he pleaded poverty, got permission to sell a certain number of heirlooms, enabling him to make compensation, and giving him something on which to live. These heirlooms, at auction, sold so unexpectedly well that my uncle acquired a taste, as it were, of what might be done. He could always prove that the rents went to the mortgagees, and that he had nothing on which to exist, so on several occasions he obtained permission from the courts to cut timber and sell pictures, until he denuded the estate and made an empty barn of the old manor house. He lived like any labourer, occupying himself sometimes as a carpenter, sometimes as a blacksmith. Indeed, he made a blacksmith's shop of the library, one of the most noble rooms in Britain, containing thousands of valuable books which again and again he applied for permission to sell, but this privilege was never granted to him. I find, on coming into the property, that my uncle quite persistently evaded the law, and depleted this superb collection book by book, surreptitiously through dealers in London. This, of course, would have got him into deep trouble if it had been discovered before his death, but now the valuable volumes are gone, and there is no redress. Many of them are doubtless in America, or in museums and collections of Europe. "You wish me to trace them, perhaps?" I interpolated. "Oh, no, they are past praying for. The old man made tens of thousands by the sale of the timber, and other thousands by disposing of the pictures. The house is denuded of its fine old furniture, which was immensely valuable. And then the books, as I have said, must have brought in the revenue of a prince, if he got anything like their value, and you may be sure he was shrewd enough to know their worth. Since the last refusal of the courts to allow him further relief, as he termed it, which was some 7 years ago, he had quite evidently been disposing of books and furniture by a private sale in defiance of the law. At that time I was under age, but my guardians opposed his application to the courts and demanded an account of the monies already in his hands. The judges upheld the opposition of my guardians and refused to allow a further spoliation of the estate, but they did not grant the accounting my guardians asked, because the proceeds of the former sales were entirely at the disposal of my uncle, and were sanctioned by the law to permit him to live as befitted his station. If he lived meagerly instead of lavishly, as my guardians contended, that, the judges said, was his affair, and there the matter ended. My uncle took a violent dislike to me, on account of this opposition to his last application, although, of course, I had nothing whatever to do with the matter. He lived like a hermit, mostly in the library, and was waited upon by an old man and his wife, and these three were the only inhabitants of a mansion that could comfortably house 100. He visited nobody, and would allow no one to approach Chizelrigg Chase. in order that all who had the misfortune to have dealing with him should continue to endure trouble after his death, he left what might be called a will, but which rather may be termed a letter to me. Here is a copy of it. My dear Tom, you will find your fortune between a couple of sheets of paper in the library. Your affectionate uncle, Reginald Moran, Earl of Chizelrigg. I should doubt if that were a legal will, said I. It doesn't need to be, replied the young man with a smile. I am next of kin, and heir to everything he possessed, although, of course, he might have given his money elsewhere, if he had chosen to do so. Why he did not bequeath it to some institution, I do not know. He knew no man personally except his own servants, whom he misused and starved. But, as he told them, he misused and starved himself, so they had no cause to grumble. He said he was treating them like one of the family. I suppose he thought it would cause me more worry and anxiety if he concealed the money and put me on the wrong scent, which I am convinced he has done, than to leave it openly to any person or charity. I need not ask if you have searched the library. Searched it? Why, there never was such a search since the world began. Possibly you put the task into incompetent hands. You are hinting, Monsieur Valmont, that I engaged others until my money was gone, and then came to you with a speculative proposal. Let me assure you such is not the case. Incompetent hands, I grant you, but the hands were my own. For the past 6 months I have lived practically as my uncle lived. I have rummaged that library from floor to ceiling. It was left in a frightful state, littered with old newspapers, accounts, and what not. Then, of course, there were the books remaining in the library, still a formidable collection. Was your uncle a religious man? I could not say. I surmise not. You see, I was unacquainted with him and never saw him until after his death. I fancy he was not religious, otherwise he could not have acted as he did. Still, he proved himself a man of such twisted mentality that anything is possible. I knew a case once where an heir who expected a large sum of money was bequeathed a family Bible, which he threw into the fire, learning afterwards to his dismay that it contained many thousands of pounds in Bank of England notes, the object of the devisor being to induce the legatee to read the good book, or suffer through the neglect of it. I have searched the scriptures, said the youthful earl with a laugh, but the benefit has been moral rather than material. Is there any chance that your uncle has deposited his wealth in a bank, and has written a cheque for the amount, leaving it between two leaves of a book? Anything is possible, monsieur, but I think that highly improbable. I have gone through every tome, page by page, and I suspect very few of the volumes have been opened for the last 20 years. How much money do you estimate he accumulated? He must have cleared more than 100,000 pounds. But speaking of banking it, I would like to say that my uncle evinced a deep distrust of banks and never drew a cheque in his life, so far as I am aware. All accounts were paid in gold by this old steward, who first brought the receipted bill in to my uncle, and then received the exact amount after having left the room, and waited until he was rung for, so that he might not learn the repository from which my uncle drew his store. I believe if the money is ever found, it will be in gold, and I am very sure that this will was written, if we may call it a will, to put us on the wrong scent. Have you had the library cleared out? Oh, no, it is practically as my uncle left it. I realize that if I were to call in help, it would be well that the newcomer found it undisturbed. You were quite right, my lord. You say you examined all the papers? Yes. So far as that is concerned, the room has been very fairly gone over. But nothing that was in it the day my uncle died has been removed, not even his anvil. His anvil? Yes, I told you he made a blacksmith's shop as well as bedroom of the library. It is a huge room, with a great fireplace at one end which formed an excellent forge. He and the steward built the forge in the eastern fireplace of brick and clay with their own hands, and erected there a second-hand blacksmith's bellows. What work did he do at his forge? Oh, anything that was required about the place. He seems to have been a very expert iron worker.
He would never buy a new implement for the garden or the house so long as he could get one second hand, and he never bought anything second hand while at his forge he might repair what was already in use. He kept an old cob on which he used to ride through the park, and he always put the shoes on this cob himself, the steward informs me, so he must have understood the use of blacksmith's tools. He made a carpenter's shop of the chief drawing room, and erected a bench there. I think a very useful mechanic was spoiled when my uncle became an earl. You have been living at the Chase since your uncle died? If you call it living, yes. The old steward and his wife have been looking after me, as they looked after my uncle, and seeing me day after day, coatless and covered with dust, I imagine they think me a second edition of the old man. Does the steward know the money is missing? No, no one knows it but myself. This will was left on the anvil in an envelope addressed to me. Your statement is exceedingly clear, Lord Chizelrigg, but I confess I don't see much daylight through it. Is there a pleasant country around Chizelrigg Chase? Very, especially at this season of the year. In autumn and winter the house is a little draughty. It needs several thousand pounds to put it in repair. Draughts do not matter in the summer. I have been long enough in England not to share the fear of my countrymen for a courant d'air. Is there a spare bed in the manor house, or shall I take down a cot with me, or, let us say, a hammock? Really, stammered the Earl, blushing again, you must not think I detailed all these circumstances in order to influence you to take up what may be a hopeless case. I, of course, am deeply interested, and therefore somewhat prone to be carried away when I begin a recital of my uncle's eccentricities. If I receive your permission, I will call on you again in a month or two. To tell you the truth, I borrowed a little money from the old steward and visited London to see my legal advisers, hoping that in the circumstances I may get permission to sell something that will keep me from starvation. When I spoke of the house being denuded, I meant relatively, of course. There are still a good many antiquities, which would doubtless bring me in a comfortable sum of money. I have been borne up by the belief that I should find my uncle's gold. Lately I have been beset by a suspicion that the old gentleman thought the library the only valuable asset left, and for this reason wrote his note, thinking I should be afraid to sell anything from that room. The old rascal must have made a pot of money out of those shelves. The catalogue shows that there was a copy of the first book printed in England by Caxton, and several priceless Shakespeares, as well as many other volumes that a collector would give a small fortune for. All these are gone. I think when I show this to be the case, the authorities cannot refuse me the right to sell something, and if I get this permission I shall at once call upon you. Nonsense, Lord Chizelrigg. Put your application in motion, if you like, and meanwhile I beg of you to look upon me as a more substantial banker than your old steward. Let us enjoy a good dinner together at the Cecil tonight, if you will do me the honour to be my guest. Tomorrow we can leave for Chizelrigg Chase. How far is it? About 3 hours, replied the young man, becoming as red as a new Queen Anne villa. Really, Monsieur Valmont, you overwhelm me with your kindness, but nevertheless I accept your generous offer. Then that's settled. What's the name of the old steward? Higgins. You are certain he has no knowledge of the hiding place of this treasure? Oh, quite sure. My uncle was not a man to make a confidant of anyone, least of all an old babbler like Higgins. Well, I should like to be introduced to Higgins as a benighted foreigner. That will make him despise me and treat me like a child. Oh, I say, protested the Earl, I should have thought you'd lived long enough in England to have got out of the notion that we do not appreciate the foreigner. Indeed, we are the only nation in the world that extends a cordial welcome to him, rich or poor. Certainement, my lord, I should be deeply disappointed did you not take me at my proper valuation. But I cherish no delusions regarding the contempt with which Higgins will regard me. He will look upon me as a sort of simpleton, to whom the Lord had been unkind by not making England my native land. Now Higgins must be led to believe that I am in his own class, that is, a servant of yours. Higgins and I will gossip over the fire together, should these spring evenings prove chilly, and before 2 or 3 weeks are past I shall have learned a great deal about your uncle that you never dreamed of. Higgins will talk more freely with a fellow servant than with his master, however much he may respect that master. And then, as I am a foreigner, he will babble down to my comprehension, and I shall get details that he never would think of giving to a fellow countryman. The young Earl's modesty, in such description of his home as he had given me, left me totally unprepared for the grandeur of the mansion, one corner of which he inhabited. It is such a place as you read of in romances of the Middle Ages, not a pinnacled or turreted French chateau of that period, but a beautiful and substantial stone manor-house of a ruddy colour, whose warm hue seemed to add a softness to the severity of its architecture. It is built round an outer and an inner courtyard, and could house a thousand, rather than the hundred with which its owner had accredited it. There are many stone-mullioned windows, and one at the end of the library might well have graced a cathedral. This superb residence occupies the centre of a heavily timbered park, and from the lodge at the gates we drove at least a mile and a half under the grandest avenue of old oaks I have ever seen. It seemed incredible that the owner of all this should actually lack the ready money to pay his fare to town. Old Higgins met us at the station with a somewhat rickety cart, to which was attached the ancient cob that the late Earl used to shoe. We entered a noble hall, which probably looked the larger because of the entire absence of any kind of furniture, unless two complete suits of venerable armour which stood on either hand might be considered as furnishing. I laughed aloud when the door was shut, and the sound echoed like the merriment of ghosts from the dim timbered roof above me. "What are you laughing at?" asked the Earl. "I am laughing to see you put your modern tall hat on that medieval helmet." "Oh, that's it. Well, put yours on the other. I mean no disrespect to the ancestor who wore this suit, but we are short of the harmless, necessary hat-rack, so I put my topper on the antique helmet, and thrust the umbrella, if I have one, in behind here, and down one of his legs. Since I came in possession, a very crafty-looking dealer from London visited me and attempted to sound me regarding the sale of these suits of armour. I gathered he would give enough money to keep me in new suits, London-made, for the rest of my life, but when I endeavoured to find out if he had had commercial dealings with my prophetic uncle, he became frightened and bolted. I imagine that if I had possessed presence of mind enough to have lured him into one of our most uncomfortable dungeons, I might have learned where some of the family treasures went to. Come up these stairs, Monsieur Valmont, and I will show you your room." We had lunched on the train coming down, so after a wash in my own room, I proceeded at once to inspect the library. It proved indeed a most noble apartment, and it had been scandalously used by the old reprobate, its late tenant. There were two huge fireplaces, one in the middle of the north wall, and the other at the eastern end. In the latter had been erected a rude brick forge, and beside the forge hung a great black bellows, smoky with usage. On a wooden block lay the anvil, and around it rested and rusted several hammers, large and small. At the western end was a glorious window filled with ancient stained glass, which, as I have said, might have adorned a cathedral. Extensive as the collection of books was, the great size of this chamber made it necessary that only the outside wall should be covered with bookcases, and even these were divided by tall windows. The opposite wall was blank, with the exception of a picture here and there, and these pictures offered a further insult to the room, for they were cheap prints, mostly coloured lithographs that had appeared in Christmas numbers of London weekly journals, encased in poverty-stricken frames, hanging from nails ruthlessly driven in above them. The floor was covered with a litter of papers, in some places knee-deep, and in the corner farthest from the forge still stood the bed on which the ancient miser had died. "Looks like a stable, doesn't it?" commented the Earl when I had finished my inspection. "I am sure the old boy simply filled it up with this rubbish to give me the trouble of examining it. Higgins tells me that up to within a month before he died the room was reasonably clear of all this muck. Of course it had to be, or the place would have caught fire from the sparks of the forge. The old man made Higgins gather all the papers he could find anywhere about the place, ancient accounts, newspapers and what not, even to the brown wrapping paper you see in which parcels came, and commanded him to strew the floor with this litter, because, as he complained, Higgins's boots on the boards made too much noise, and Higgins, who is not in the least of an inquiring mind, accepted this explanation as entirely meeting the case. Higgins proved to be a garrulous old fellow who needed no urging to talk about the late Earl. Indeed, it was almost impossible to deflect his conversation into any other channel. 20 years' intimacy with the eccentric nobleman had largely obliterated that sense of deference with which an English servant usually approaches his master. An English underling's idea of nobility is the man who never by any possibility works with his hands. The fact that Lord Chizelrigg had toiled at the carpenter's bench, had mixed cement in the drawing-room, had caused the anvil to ring out till midnight, aroused no admiration in Higgins's mind. In addition to this, the ancient nobleman had been penuriously strict in his examination of accounts, exacting the uttermost farthing, so the humble servitor regarded his memory with supreme contempt. I realised before the drive was finished from the station to Chizelrigg Chase that there was little use of introducing me to Higgins as a foreigner and a fellow servant. I found myself completely unable to understand what the old fellow said. His dialect was as unknown to me as the Choctaw language would have been, and the young Earl was compelled to act as interpreter on the occasions when we set this garrulous talking machine going. The new Earl of Chizelrigg, with the enthusiasm of a boy, proclaimed himself my pupil and assistant, and said he would do whatever he was told. His thorough and fruitless search of the library had convinced him that the old man was merely chaffing him, as he put it, by leaving such a letter as he had written. His lordship was certain that the money had been hidden somewhere else, probably buried under one of the trees in the park. Of course this was possible, and represented the usual method by which a stupid person conceals treasure. Yet I did not think it probable. All conversations with Higgins showed the Earl to have been an extremely suspicious man, suspicious of banks, suspicious even of Bank of England notes, suspicious of every person on earth, not omitting Higgins himself. Therefore, as I told his nephew, the miser would never allow the fortune out of his sight and immediate reach. From the first, the oddity of the forge and anvil being placed in his bedroom struck me as peculiar, and I said to the young man, "I'll stake my reputation that forge or anvil or both contain the secret. You see, the old gentleman worked sometimes till midnight, for Higgins could hear his hammering. If he used hard coal on the forge, the fire would last through the night, and being in continual terror of thieves, as Higgins says, barricading the castle every evening before dark as if it were a fortress, he was bound to place the treasure in the most unlikely spot for a thief to get at it. Now the coal fire smouldered all night long, and if the gold was in the forge underneath the embers, it would be extremely difficult to get at. A robber rummaging in the dark would burn his fingers in more senses than one. Then, as his lordship kept no less than 4 loaded revolvers under his pillow, all he had to do, if a thief entered his room, was to allow the search to go on until the thief started at the forge, then doubtless, as he had the range with reasonable accuracy night or day, he might sit up in bed and blaze away with revolver after revolver. There were 28 shots that could be fired in about double as many seconds, so you see the robber stood little chance in the face of such a fusillade. I propose that we dismantle the forge." Lord Chizelrigg was much taken by my reasoning, and one morning, early, we cut down the big bellows, tore it open, found it empty, then took brick after brick from the forge with a crowbar, for the old man had builded better than he knew with Portland cement. In fact, when we cleared away the rubbish between the bricks and the core of the furnace, we came upon one cube of cement which was as hard as granite. With the aid of Higgins and a set of rollers and levers, we managed to get this block out into the park and attempted to crush it with the sledge-hammers belonging to the forge, in which we were entirely unsuccessful. The more it resisted our efforts, the more certain we became that the coins would be found within it.
As this would not be treasure trove in the sense that the government might make a claim upon it, there was no particular necessity for secrecy, so we had up a man from the mines nearby with drills and dynamite, who speedily shattered the block into a million pieces, more or less. Alas, there was no trace in its debris of pay dirt, as the Western miner puts it. While the dynamite expert was on the spot, we induced him to shatter the anvil, as well as the block of cement, and then the workman, doubtless thinking the new earl was as insane as the old one had been, shouldered his tools and went back to his mine. The earl reverted to his former opinion that the gold was concealed in the park, while I held even more firmly to my own belief that the fortune rested in the library. "It is obvious," I said to him, "that if the treasure is buried outside, someone must have dug the hole. A man so timorous and so reticent as your uncle would allow no one to do this but himself." Higgins maintained the other evening that all picks and spades were safely locked up by himself each night in the tool-house. The mansion itself was barricaded with such exceeding care that it would have been difficult for your uncle to get outside, even if he had wished to do so. Then such a man as your uncle is described to have been would continually desire ocular demonstration that his savings were intact, which would be practically impossible if the gold had found a grave in the park. I propose now that we abandon violence and dynamite and proceed to an intellectual search of the library. "Very well," replied the young earl, "but as I have already searched the library very thoroughly, your use of the word intellectual, Monsieur Valmont, is not in accord with your customary politeness. However, I am with you. 'Tis for you to command and me to obey." "Pardon me, my lord," I said. "I use the word intellectual in contradistinction to the word dynamite. It had no reference to your former search. I merely propose that we now abandon the use of chemical reaction and employ the much greater force of mental activity. Did you notice any writing on the margins of the newspapers you examined?" "No, I did not." "Is it possible that there may have been some communication on the white border of a newspaper?" "It is, of course, possible." "Then will you set yourself to the task of glancing over the margin of every newspaper, piling them away in another room when your scrutiny of each is complete? Do not destroy anything, but we must clear out the library completely. I am interested in the accounts, and will examine them." It was exasperatingly tedious work, but after several days my assistant reported every margin scanned without result, while I had collected each bill and memorandum, classifying them according to date. I could not get rid of a suspicion that the contrary old beast had written instructions for the finding of the treasure on the back of some account, or on the fly-leaf of a book, and as I looked at the thousands of volumes still left in the library, the prospect of such a patient and minute search appalled me. But I remembered Edison's words to the effect that if a thing exist, search, exhaustive enough, will find it. From the mass of accounts I selected several, the rest I placed in another room alongside the heap of the Earl's newspapers. "Now," said I to my helper, "if it please you, we will have Higgins in, as I wish some explanation of these accounts." "Perhaps I can assist you," suggested his lordship, drawing up a chair opposite the table on which I had spread the statements. "I have lived here for 6 months, and know as much about things as Higgins does. He is so difficult to stop when once he begins to talk. What is the first account you wish further light upon?" "To go back 13 years, I find that your uncle bought a second-hand safe in Sheffield. Here is the bill. I consider it necessary to find that safe." "Pray forgive me, Monsieur Valmont," cried the young man, springing to his feet and laughing. "So heavy an article as a safe should not slip readily from a man's memory, but it did from mine. The safe is empty, and I gave no more thought to it." Saying this, the earl went to one of the bookcases that stood against the wall, pulled it round as if it were a door, books and all, and displayed the front of an iron safe, the door of which he also drew open, exhibiting the usual empty interior of such a receptacle. "I came on this," he said, "when I took down all these volumes. It appears that there was once a secret door leading from the library into an outside room which has long since disappeared. The walls are very thick.
My uncle doubtless caused this door to be taken off its hinges and the safe placed in the aperture, the rest of which he then bricked up.
Quite so, said I, endeavouring to conceal my disappointment. As this strong box was bought second hand and not made to order, I suppose there can be no secret crannies in it.
It looks like a common or garden safe, reported my assistant, but we'll have it out if you say so.
Not just now, I replied. We've had enough of dynamiting to make us feel like housebreakers already.
I agree with you. What's the next item on the programme?
Your uncle's mania for buying things at second hand was broken in three instances, so far as I have been able to learn from a scrutiny of these accounts. About 4 years ago he purchased a new book from Denny and Company, the well-known booksellers of the Strand. Denny and Co. deal only in new books.
Is there any comparatively new volume in the library?
Not one.
Are you sure of that?
Oh, quite. I searched all the literature in the house.
What is the name of the volume he bought?
That I cannot decipher. The initial letter looks like M, but the rest is a mere wavy line. I see, however, that it cost 12 and 6 pence, while the cost of carriage by parcel post was 6 pence, which shows it weighed something under 4 pounds. This, with the price of the book, induces me to think that it was a scientific work, printed on heavy paper and illustrated.
I know nothing of it, said the Earl.
The third account is for wallpaper. 27 rolls of an expensive wallpaper, and 27 rolls of a cheap paper, the latter being just half the price of the former. This wallpaper seems to have been supplied by a tradesman in the station road in the village of Chizelrigg.
There's your wallpaper, cried the youth, waving his hand.
He was going to paper the whole house, Higgins told me, but got tired after he had finished the library, which took him nearly a year to accomplish, for he worked at it very intermittently, mixing the paste in the boudoir, a pailful at a time as he needed it. It was a scandalous thing to do, for underneath the paper is the most exquisite oak panelling, very plain, but very rich in colour. I rose and examined the paper on the wall. It was dark brown and answered the description of the expensive paper on the bill.
What became of the cheap paper? I asked.
I don't know.
I think, said I, we are on the track of the mystery. I believe that paper covers a sliding panel or concealed door.
It is very likely, replied the Earl. I intended to have the paper off, but I had no money to pay a workman, and I am not so industrious as was my uncle.
What is your remaining account?
The last also pertains to paper, but comes from a firm in Budge Row, London, E.C. He has had, it seems, 1,000 sheets of it, and it appears to have been frightfully expensive. This bill is also illegible, but I take it 1,000 sheets were supplied, although, of course, it may have been 1,000 quires, which would be a little more reasonable for the price charged, or 1,000 reams, which would be exceedingly cheap.
I don't know anything about that.
Let's turn on Higgins. Higgins knew nothing of this last order of paper either. The wallpaper mystery he at once cleared up. Apparently the old Earl had discovered by experiment that the heavy, expensive wallpaper would not stick to the glossy panelling, so he had purchased a cheaper paper and had pasted that on first. Higgins said he had gone all over the panelling with a yellowish-white paper, and after that was dry, he pasted over it the more expensive rolls.
But, I objected, the two papers were bought and delivered at the same time. Therefore he could not have found by experiment that the heavy paper would not stick.
I don't think there is much in that, commented the Earl. The heavy paper may have been bought first and found to be unsuitable, and then the coarse cheap paper bought afterwards. The bill merely shows that the account was sent in on that date. Indeed, as the village of Chizelrigg is but a few miles away, it would have been quite possible for my uncle to have bought the heavy paper in the morning, tried it, and in the afternoon sent for the commoner lot. But in any case, the bill would not have been presented until months after the order, and the two purchasers were thus lumped together. I was forced to confess that this seemed reasonable. Now about the book ordered from Denny's, did Higgins remember anything regarding it?
It came 4 years ago. Ah, yes, Higgins did. He remembered it very well indeed. He had come in one morning with the Earl's tea, and the old man was sitting up in bed reading his volume with such interest that he was unaware of Higgins's knock, and Higgins himself, being a little hard of hearing, took for granted the command to enter. The Earl hastily thrust the book under the pillow alongside the revolvers, and rated Higgins in a most cruel way for entering the room before getting permission to do so. He had never seen the Earl so angry before, and he laid it all to this book. It was after the book had come that the forge had been erected and the anvil bought. Higgins never saw the book again, but one morning, 6 months before the Earl died, Higgins, in raking out the cinders of the forge, found what he supposed was a portion of the book's cover. He believed his master had burnt the volume. Having dismissed Higgins, I said to the Earl, "The first thing to be done is to enclose this bill to Denny and Company, Booksellers Strand. Tell them you have lost the volume, and ask them to send another. There is likely someone in the shop who can decipher the illegible writing. I am certain the book will give us a clue. Now I shall write to Brown and Sons, Budge Row. This is evidently a French company. In fact, the name, as connected with papermaking, runs in my mind, although I cannot at this moment place it. I shall ask them the use of this paper that they furnished to the late Earl." This was done accordingly. And now, as we thought, until the answers came, we were two men out of work. Yet the next morning, I am pleased to say, and I have always rather plumed myself on the fact, I solved the mystery before replies were received from London. Of course, both the book and the answer of the paper agents, by putting two and two together, would have given us the key. After breakfast, I strolled somewhat aimlessly into the library, whose floor was now strewn merely with brown wrapping paper, bits of string and all that. As I shuffled among this with my feet, as if tossing aside dead autumn leaves in a forest path, my attention was suddenly drawn to several squares of paper, unwrinkled, and never used for wrapping. These sheets seemed to me strangely familiar. I picked one of them up, and at once the significance of the name Brown and Sons occurred to me. They are papermakers in France who produce a smooth, very tough sheet, which, dear as it is, proves infinitely cheap compared with the fine vellum it deposed in a certain branch of industry. In Paris, years before, these sheets had given me the knowledge of how a gang of thieves disposed of their gold without melting it. The paper was used instead of vellum in the rougher processes of manufacturing gold leaf. It stood the constant beating of the hammer nearly as well as the vellum. And here at once there flashed on me the secret of the old man's midnight anvil work. He was transforming his sovereigns into gold leaf, which must have been of a rude, thick kind, because to produce the gold leaf of commerce he still needed the vellum, as well as a clutch and other machinery, of which we had found no trace. "My lord," I called to my assistant. He was at the other end of the room. "I wish to test a theory on the anvil of your own fresh common sense." "Hammer away," replied the Earl, approaching me with his usual good-natured, jocular expression. "I eliminate the safe from our investigations because it was purchased 13 years ago. But the buying of the book, of wall covering, of this tough paper from France, all group themselves into a set of incidents occurring within the same month as the purchase of the anvil and the building of the forge. Therefore, I think they are related to one another. Here are some sheets of paper he got from Budge Row. Have you ever seen anything like it? Try to tear this sample." "It's reasonably tough," admitted his lordship, fruitlessly endeavouring to rip it apart. "Yes, it was made in France, and is used in gold beating. Your uncle beat his sovereigns into gold leaf. You will find that the book from Denny's is a volume on gold beating. And now, as I remember that scribbled word which I could not make out, I think the title of the volume is Metallurgy. It contains, no doubt, a chapter on the manufacture of gold leaf." "I believe you," said the Earl, "but I don't see that the discovery sets us any further forward. We are now looking for gold leaf instead of sovereigns."
"Let's examine this wallpaper," said I. I placed my knife under a corner of it at the floor and quite easily ripped off a large section. As Higgins had said, the brown paper was on top and the coarse, light-coloured paper underneath. But even that came away from the oak panelling as easily as though it hung there from habit and not because of paste.
"Feel the weight of that," I cried, handing him the sheet I had torn from the wall.
"By Jove!" said the Earl, in a voice almost of awe.
I took it from him and laid it face downwards on the wooden table, threw a little water on the back, and with a knife scraped away the porous white paper. Instantly there gleamed up at us the baleful yellow of the gold. I shrugged my shoulders and spread out my hands. The Earl of Chizelrigg laughed aloud and very heartily. "You see how it is," I cried. "The old man first covered the entire wall with this whitish paper. He heated his sovereigns at the forge and beat them out on the anvil, then completed the process rudely between the sheets of this paper from France. Probably he pasted the gold to the wall as soon as he shut himself in for the night, and covered it over with the more expensive paper before Higgins entered in the morning. We found afterwards, however, that he had actually fastened the thick sheets of gold to the wall with carpet tacks. His lordship netted a trifle over £123,000 through my discovery. And I am pleased to pay tribute to the young man's generosity by saying that his voluntary settlement made my bank account swell stout as a city alderman." End of Chapter 4. Lord Chizelrigg's Missing Fortune.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Chet Chris, London, UK. The Triumphs of Eugene Valmont by Robert Barr. Chapter 5. The Absent-Minded Coterie. Some years ago, I enjoyed the unique experience of pursuing a man for one crime and getting evidence against him of another. He was innocent of the misdemeanour, the proof of which I sought, but was guilty of another most serious offence. Yet he and his confederates escaped scot-free in circumstances which I now purpose to relate. You may remember that in Rudyard Kipling's story, Bedalia Herodsfoot, the unfortunate woman's husband ran the risk of being arrested as a simple drunkard, at a moment when the blood of murder was upon his boots. The case of Ralph Summertrees was rather the reverse of this. The English authorities were trying to fasten upon him a crime almost as important as murder, while I was collecting evidence which proved him guilty of an action much more momentous than that of drunkenness. The English authorities have always been good enough, when they recognise my existence at all, to look down upon me with amused condescension. If today you ask Spencer Hale of Scotland Yard what he thinks of Eugene Valmont, that complacent man will put on the superior smile which so well becomes him, and if you are a very intimate friend of his, he may draw down the lid of his right eye as he replies, "Oh yes, a very decent fellow, Valmont, but he's a Frenchman," as if, that said, there was no need of further inquiry. Myself, I like the English detective very much, and if I were to be in a melee tomorrow, there is no man I would rather find beside me than Spencer Hale. In any situation where a fist that can fell an ox is desirable, my friend Hale is a useful companion. But for intellectuality, mental acumen, finesse, ah, well, I am the most modest of men, and will say nothing. It would amuse you to see this giant come into my room during an evening, on the bluff pretence that he wishes to smoke a pipe with me. There is the same difference between this good-natured giant and myself as exists between that strong black pipe of his and my delicate cigarette, which I smoke feverishly when he is present, to protect myself from the fumes of his terrible tobacco. I look with delight upon the huge man, who, with an air of the utmost good humour, and a twinkle in his eye, as he thinks he is twisting me about his finger, vainly endeavours to obtain a hint regarding whatever case is perplexing him at that moment. I baffle him with the ease that an active greyhound eludes the pursuit of a heavy mastiff, and then at last I say to him with a laugh, "Come, mon ami Hale, tell me all about it, and I will help you if I can." Once or twice at the beginning he shook his massive head, and replied the secret was not his. The last time he did this I assured him that what he said was quite correct, and then I related full particulars of the situation in which he found himself, excepting the names, for these he had not mentioned. I had pieced together his perplexity from scraps of conversation in his half-hour's fishing for my advice, which, of course, he could have had for the plain asking. Since that time he has not come to me except with cases he feels at liberty to reveal, and one or two complications I have happily been enabled to unravel for him. But staunch as Spencer Hale holds the belief that no detective service on earth can excel that centring in Scotland Yard, there is one department of activity in which even he confesses that Frenchmen are his masters, although he somewhat grudgingly qualifies his admission by adding that we in France are constantly allowed to do what is prohibited in England. I refer to the minute search of a house during the owner's absence. If you read that excellent story entitled The Purloined Letter by Edgar Allan Poe, you will find a record of the kind of thing I mean, which is better than any description I, who have so often taken part in such a search, can set down. Now, these people among whom I live are proud of their phrase, "The Englishman's house is his castle," and into that castle even a policeman cannot penetrate without a legal warrant. This may be all very well in theory, but if you are compelled to march up to a man's house blowing a trumpet and rattling a snare drum, you need not be disappointed if you fail to find what you are in search of when all the legal restrictions are complied with. Of course, the English are a very excellent people, a fact to which I am always proud to bear testimony, but it must be admitted that for cold common sense, the French are very much their superiors. In Paris, if I wish to obtain an incriminating document, I do not send the possessor a carte postale to inform him of my desire, and in this procedure the French people sanely acquiesce. I have known men who, when they go out to spend an evening on the boulevards, toss their bunch of keys to the concierge, saying, "If you hear the police rummaging about while I'm away, pray assist them," with an expression of my distinguished consideration. I remember when I was chief detective in the service of the French government, being requested to call at a certain hour at the private hotel of the Minister for Foreign Affairs. It was during the time that Bismarck meditated a second attack upon my country, and I am happy to say that I was then instrumental in supplying the secret bureau with documents which mollified that iron man's purpose, a fact which I think entitled me to my country's gratitude. Not that I have ever even hinted such a claim when a succeeding ministry forgot my services. The memory of a republic, as has been said by a greater man than I, is short. However, all that has nothing to do with the incident I am about to relate. I merely mention the crisis to excuse a momentary forgetfulness on my part, which in any other country might have been followed by serious results to myself. But in France, we understand those things, and nothing happened. I am the last person in the world to give myself away, as they say in the Great West. I am usually the calm, collected Eugene Valmont, whom nothing can perturb. But this was a time of great tension, and I had become absorbed. I was alone with the minister in his private house, and one of the papers he desired was in his bureau at the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. At least, he thought so, and said, "Ah, it is in my desk at the bureau. How annoying! I must send for it." "No, Excellency," I cried, springing up in a self-oblivion the most complete. "It is here." Touching the spring of a secret drawer, I opened it and, taking out the document he wished, handed it to him. It was not until I met his searching look and saw the faint smile on his lips that I realized what I had done. "Valmont," he said quietly, "on whose behalf did you search my house?" "Excellency," I replied, in tones no less agreeable than his own, "tonight, at your orders, I pay a domiciliary visit to the mansion of Baron Dumoulin, who stands high in the estimation of the President of the French Republic. If either of those distinguished gentlemen should learn of my informal call, and should ask me in whose interests I made the domiciliary visit, what is it you wish that I should reply?" "You should reply, Valmont, that you did it in the interests of the Secret Service." "I shall not fail to do so, Excellency. And in answer to your question just now, I had the honour of searching this mansion in the interests of the Secret Service of France." The Minister for Foreign Affairs laughed, a hearty laugh that expressed no resentment. "I merely wish to compliment you, Valmont, on the efficiency of your search and the excellency of your memory. This is indeed the document which I thought was left in my office. I wonder what Lord Lansdowne would say if Spencer Hale showed an equal familiarity with his private papers. But now that we have returned to our good friend Hale, we must not keep him waiting any longer." I well remember the November day when I first heard of the Summertrees case, because there hung over London a fog so thick that two or three times I lost my way, and no cab was to be had at any price. The few cabmen then in the streets were leading their animals slowly along, making for their stables. It was one of those depressing London days which filled me with ennui and a yearning for my own clear city of Paris, where, if we are ever visited by a slight mist, it is at least clean, white vapour, and not this horrible London mixture saturated with suffocating carbon. The fog was too thick for any passer to read the contents bills of the newspapers plastered on the pavement, and as there were probably no races that day, the newsboys were shouting what they considered the next most important event, the election of an American president. I bought a paper and thrust it into my pocket. It was late when I reached my flat, and after dining there, which was an unusual thing for me to do, I put on my slippers, took an easy chair before the fire, and began to read my evening journal. I was distressed to learn that the eloquent Mr. Bryan had been defeated. I knew little about the silver question, but the man's oratorical powers had appealed to me, and my sympathy was aroused because he owned many silver mines, and yet the price of the metal was so low that apparently he could not make a living through the operation of them. But, of course, the cry that he was a plutocrat and a reputed millionaire over and over again was bound to defeat him in a democracy where the average voter is exceedingly poor and not comfortably well-to-do, as is the case with our peasants in France. I always took great interest in the affairs of the huge republic to the west, having been at some pains to inform myself accurately regarding its politics, and although, as my readers know, I seldom quote anything complimentary that is said of me. Nevertheless, an American client of mine once admitted that he never knew the true inwardness, I think that was the phrase he used, of American politics, until he heard me discourse upon them. But then, he added, he had been a very busy man all his life. I had allowed my paper to slip to the floor, for in very truth the fog was penetrating even into my flat, and it was becoming difficult to read, notwithstanding the electric light. My man came in and announced that Mr. Spencer Hale wished to see me, and indeed any night, but especially when there is rain or fog outside, I am more pleased to talk with a friend than to read a newspaper. "Mon Dieu, my dear Monsieur Hale, it is a brave man you are to venture out in such a fog as is abroad tonight." "Ah, Monsieur Valmont," said Hale with pride, "you cannot raise a fog like this in Paris." "No, there you are supreme," I admitted, rising and saluting my visitor, then offering him a chair. "I see you're reading the latest news," he said, indicating my newspaper. I'm very glad that man Brian is defeated. Now we shall have better times. I waved my hand as I took my chair again. I will discuss many things with Spencer Hale, but not American politics. He does not understand them. It is a common defect of the English to suffer complete ignorance regarding the internal affairs of other countries. It is surely an important thing that brought you out on such a night as this. The fog must be very thick in Scotland Yard. This delicate shaft of fancy completely missed him, and he answered stolidly, "It's thick all over London, and indeed throughout most of England." "Yes, it is," I agreed. But he did not see that either. Still a moment later, he made a remark which, if it had come from some people I know, might have indicated a glimmer of comprehension. "You are a very, very clever man, Monsieur Valmont, so all I need say is that the question which brought me here is the same as that on which the American election was fought. Now, to a countryman, I shall be compelled to give further explanation, but to you, Monsieur, that will not be necessary." There are times when I dislike the crafty smile and partial closing of the eyes which always distinguishes Spencer Hale when he places on the table a problem which he expects will baffle me. If I said he never did baffle me, I would be wrong, of course, for sometimes the utter simplicity of the puzzles which trouble him leads me into an intricate involution entirely unnecessary in the circumstances. I pressed my fingertips together and gazed for a few moments at the ceiling. Hale had lit his black pipe, and my silent servant placed at his elbow the whiskey and soda, then tiptoed out of the room. As the door closed, my eyes came from the ceiling to the level of Hale's expansive countenance. "Have they eluded you?" I asked quietly. "Who?" "The coiners." Hale's pipe dropped from his jaw, but he managed to catch it before it reached the floor. Then he took a gulp from the tumbler. "That was just a lucky shot," he said. "Parfaitement," I replied carelessly. "Now own up, Valmont, wasn't it?" I shrugged my shoulders. A man cannot contradict a guest in his own house. "Oh, stow that," cried Hale impolitely. He's a trifle prone to strong and even slangy expressions when puzzled. "Tell me how you guessed it." "It is very simple, mon ami. The question on which the American election was fought is the price of silver, which is so low that it has ruined Mr. Bryan, and threatens to ruin all the farmers of the West who possess silver mines on their farms. Silver troubled America, ergo silver troubles Scotland Yard." "Very well. The natural inference is that someone has stolen bars of silver. But such a theft happened 3 months ago, when the metal was being unloaded from a German steamer at Southampton, and my dear friend Spencer Hale ran down the thieves very cleverly as they were trying to dissolve the marks off the bars with acid. Now, crimes do not run in series, like the numbers in roulette at Monte Carlo. The thieves are men of brains. They say to themselves, 'What chance is there successfully to steal bars of silver while Mr. Hale is at Scotland Yard?' Eh, my good friend?" "Really, Valmont," said Hale, taking another sip, "sometimes you almost persuade me that you have reasoning powers." "Thanks, comrade." "Then it is not a theft of silver we have now to deal with, but the American election was fought on the price of silver. If silver had been high in cost, there would have been no silver question. So the crime that is bothering you arises through the low price of silver. And this suggests that it must be a case of illicit coinage, for there the low price of the metal comes in. You have, perhaps, found a more subtle illegitimate act going forward than heretofore. Someone is making your shillings and your half-crowns from real silver instead of from baser metal, and yet there is a large profit which has not hitherto been possible through the high price of silver. With the old conditions you were familiar, but this new element sets at naught all your previous formulae. That is how I reasoned the matter out." "Well, Valmont, you've hit it. I'll say that for you. You've hit it. There is a gang of expert coiners who are putting out real silver money, and making a clear shilling on the half-crown. We can find no trace of the coiners, but we know the man who's shoving the stuff. That ought to be sufficient, I suggested. Yes, it should, but it hasn't proved so up to date. Now, I came tonight to see if you would do one of your French tricks for us, right on the quiet. What French trick, Monsieur Spencer Hale? I inquired with some asperity, forgetting for the moment that the man invariably became impolite when he grew excited. No offence intended, said this blundering officer, who really is a good-natured fellow, but always puts his foot in it and then apologises. I want someone to go through a man's house without a search warrant. Spot the evidence, let me know, and then we'll rush the place before he has time to hide his tracks. Who is this man, and where does he live? His name is Ralph Summertrees, and he lives in a very natty little bijou residence, as the advertisements call it, situated in no less a fashionable street than Park Lane. I see. What has aroused your suspicions against him? Well, you know, that's an expensive district to live in. It takes a bit of money to do the trick. This Summertrees has no ostensible business, yet every Friday he goes to the United Capital Bank in Piccadilly and deposits a bag of swag, usually all silver coin. Yes, and this money? This money, so far as we can learn, contains a good many of these new pieces which never saw the British Mint. It's not all the new coinage, then. Oh, no, he's a bit too artful for that. You see, a man can go round London, his pockets filled with new coinage five-shilling pieces, buy this, that, and the other, and come home with his change in legitimate coins of the realm, half-crowns, florins, shillings, sixpences, and all that. I see. Then why don't you nab him one day when his pockets are stuffed with illegitimate five-shilling pieces? That could be done, of course, and I've thought of it, but you see, we want to land the whole gang. Once we arrested him without knowing where the money came from, the real coiners would take flight. How do you know he is not the real coiner himself? Now, poor Hale is as easy to read as a book. He hesitated before answering this question and looked confused as a culprit caught in some dishonest act. "You need not be afraid to tell me," I said soothingly, after a pause. "You have had one of your men in Mr. Summertrees' house, and so learned that he is not the coiner. But your man has not succeeded in getting you evidence to incriminate other people. You have about hit it again, Monsieur Valmont. One of my men has been Summertrees' butler for 2 weeks, but, as you say, he's found no evidence. Is he still butler? Yes. Now, tell me how far you have got. You know that Summertrees deposits a bag of coin every Friday in the Piccadilly Bank, and I suppose the bank has allowed you to examine one or two of the bags. Yes, sir, they have. But you see, banks are very difficult to treat with. They don't like detectives bothering around. And whilst they do not stand out against the law, still they never answer any more questions than they're asked. And Mr. Summertrees has been a good customer at the United Capital for many years. Haven't you found out where the money comes from? Yes, we have. It's brought there night after night by a man who looks like a respectable city clerk. And he puts it into a large safe, of which he holds the key, this safe being on the ground floor in the dining room. Haven't you followed the clerk? Yes. He sleeps in the Park Lane house every night and goes up in the morning to an old curiosity shop in Tottenham Court Road, where he stays all day, returning with his bag of money in the evening. Why don't you arrest and question him? Well, Monsieur Valmont, there is just the same objection to his arrest as to that of Summertrees himself. We could easily arrest both, but we have not the slightest evidence against either of them. And then, although we put the go-betweens in clink, the worst criminals of the lot would escape. Nothing suspicious about the old curiosity shop? No, it appears to be perfectly regular. This game has been going on under your noses for how long?
For about 6 weeks.
Is Summertrees a married man?
No.
Are there any women servants in the house?
No. Except that three charwomen come in every morning to do up the rooms.
Of what is his household comprised? There's the butler, then the valet, and last, the French cook.
Ah, cried I, the French cook. This case interests me.
So Summertrees has succeeded in completely disconcerting your man. Has he prevented him going from top to bottom of the house?
No, he's rather assisted him than otherwise. On one occasion he went to the safe, took out the money, had Podgers, that's my chap's name, help him count it, and then actually sent Podgers to the bank with the bag of coin.
And Podgers has been all over the place?
Yes.
Saw no signs of a coining establishment?
No. It's absolutely impossible that any coining can be done there. Besides, as I tell you, that respectable clerk brings him the money.
I suppose you want me to take Podger's position.
Well, Monsieur Valmont, to tell you the truth, I would rather you didn't. Podgers has done everything a man can do, but I thought if you got into the house, Podgers assisting, you might go through it night after night at your leisure.
I see. That's just a little dangerous in England. I think I should prefer to assure myself the legitimate standing of being the amiable Podgers' successor.
You say that Summertrees has no business?
Well, sir, not what you might call a business. He's by the way of being an author, but I don't count that any business.
Oh, an author, is he? When does he do his writing?
He locks himself up most of the day in his study.
Does he come out for lunch?
No. He lights a little spirit lamp inside, Podgers tells me, and makes himself a cup of coffee, which he takes with a sandwich or two.
That's rather frugal fare for Park Lane.
Yes, Monsieur Valmont, it is. But he makes up for it in the evening, when he has a long dinner with all them foreign kickshaws you people like, done by his French cook.
Sensible man.
Well, Hale, I see I shall look forward with pleasure to making the acquaintance of Mr. Summertrees. Is there any restriction on the going and coming of your man Podgers?
None in the least. He can get away either night or day.
Very good, friend Hale. Bring him here tomorrow, as soon as our author locks himself up in his study, or rather, I should say, as soon as the respectable clerk leaves for Tottenham Court Road, which I should guess, as you put it, is about half an hour after his master turns the key of the room in which he writes.
You are quite right in that guess, Valmont.
How did you hit it?
Merely a surmise, Hale.
There is a good deal of oddity about that Park Lane house, so it doesn't surprise me in the least that the master gets to work earlier in the morning than the man. I have also a suspicion that Ralph Summertrees knows perfectly well what the estimable Podgers is there for.
What makes you think that?
I can give no reason, except that my opinion of the acuteness of Summertrees has been gradually rising all the while you were speaking, and at the same time my estimate of Podgers' craft has been as steadily declining. However, bring the man here tomorrow, that I may ask him a few questions.
Next day, about 11 o'clock, the ponderous Podgers, hat in hand, followed his chief into my room. His broad, impassive, immobile, smooth face gave him rather more the air of a genuine butler than I had expected, and this appearance, of course, was enhanced by his livery. His replies to my questions were those of a well-trained servant who will not say too much unless it is made worth his while. All in all, Podgers exceeded my expectations, and really my friend Hale had some justification for regarding him, as he evidently did, a triumph in his line.
"Sit down, Mr. Hale, and you, Podgers." The man disregarded my invitation, standing like a statue until his chief made a motion. Then he dropped into a chair. The English are great on discipline.
"Now, Mr. Hale, I must first congratulate you on the make-up of Podgers. It is excellent. You depend less on artificial assistance than we do in France, and in that I think you are right."
"Oh, we know a bit over here, Monsieur Valmont," said Hale, with pardonable pride.
"Now then, Podgers, I want to ask you about this clerk. What time does he arrive in the evening?"
"At prompt 6, sir."
"Does he ring, or let himself in with a latch-key?"
"With a latch-key, sir."
"How does he carry the money?"
"In a little locked leather satchel, sir, flung over his shoulder."
Does he go direct to the dining room? Yes, sir. Have you seen him unlock the safe and put in the money? Yes, sir. Does the safe unlock with a word or a key? With a key, sir. It's one of the old-fashioned kind. Then the clerk unlocks his leather money bag? Yes, sir. That's three keys used within as many minutes. Are they separate or in a bunch? In a bunch, sir. Did you ever see your master with this bunch of keys? No, sir. You saw him open the safe once, I'm told. Yes, sir. Did he use a separate key or one of a bunch? Podgers slowly scratched his head, then said, I don't just remember, sir. Ah, Podgers, you are neglecting the big things in that house. Sure you can't remember? No, sir. Once the money is in and the safe locked up, what does the clerk do? Goes to his room, sir. Where is this room? On the third floor, sir. Where do you sleep? On the fourth floor with the rest of the servants, sir. Where does the master sleep? On the second floor, adjoining his study. The house consists of four stories and a basement, does it? Yes, sir. I have somehow arrived at the suspicion that it is a very narrow house. Is that true? Yes, sir. Does the clerk ever dine with your master? No, sir. The clerk don't eat in the house at all, sir. Does he go away before breakfast? No, sir. No one takes breakfast to his room? No, sir. What time does he leave the house? At 10 o'clock, sir. When is breakfast served? At 9 o'clock, sir. At what hour does your master retire to his study? At 9:30, sir. Locks the door on the inside? Yes, sir. Never rings for anything during the day? Not that I know of, sir. What sort of a man is he? Here Podgers was on familiar ground, and he rattled off a description minute in every particular. What I meant was, Podgers, is he silent or talkative, or does he get angry? Does he seem furtive, suspicious, anxious, terrorised, calm, excitable, or what? Well, sir, he is by way of being very quiet. Never has much to say for himself. Never saw him angry or excited. Now, Podgers, you've been at Park Lane for a fortnight or more. You are a sharp, alert, observant man. What happens there that strikes you as unusual? Well, can't exactly say, sir, replied Podgers, looking rather helplessly from his chief to myself and back again. Your professional duties have often compelled you to enact the part of butler before, otherwise you wouldn't do it so well. Isn't that the case? Podgers did not reply, but glanced at his chief. This was evidently a question pertaining to the service which a subordinate was not allowed to answer. However, Hale said at once, Certainly. Podgers has been in dozens of places. Well, Podgers, just call to mind some of the other households where you've been employed, and tell me any particulars in which Mr. Summertree's establishment differs from them. Podgers pondered a long time. Well, sir, he do stick to writing pretty close. Ah, that's his profession, you see, Podgers. Hard at it from 9:30 till towards 7, I imagine. Yes, sir. Anything else, Podgers, no matter how trivial? Well, sir, he's fond of reading, too. At leastways, he's fond of newspapers. When does he read? I've never seen him read 'em, sir. Indeed, as far as I can tell, I never knew the papers to be opened, but he takes them all in, sir. What, all the morning papers? Yes, sir, and all the evening papers, too. Where are the morning papers placed? On the table in his study, sir. And the evening papers? Well, sir, when the evening papers come, the study is locked. They are put on a side table in the dining room, and he takes them upstairs with him to his study. This has happened every day since you've been there? Yes, sir. You reported that very striking fact to your chief, of course. No, sir, I don't think I did, said Podgers, confused. You should have done so. Mr. Hale would have known how to make the most of a point so vital. Oh, come now, Valmont, interrupted Hale, you're chaffing us. Plenty of people taking all the papers.
I think not. Even clubs and hotels subscribe to the leading journals only.
You said all, I think, Podgers.
Well, nearly all, sir.
But which is it? There's a vast difference.
It takes a good many, sir.
How many?
I don't just know, sir.
That's easily found out, Valmont, cried Hale with some impatience, if you think it really important.
I think it's so important that I'm going back with Podgers myself.
You can take me into the house, I suppose, when you return?
Oh, yes, sir.
Coming back to these newspapers for a moment, Podgers, what's done with them?
They're sold to the ragman, sir, once a week.
Who takes them from the study?
I do, sir.
Do they appear to have been read very carefully?
Well, no, sir. Leastways, some of them seem never to have been opened, or else folded up very carefully again.
Did you notice that extracts have been clipped from any of them?
No, sir.
Does Mr. Summertrees keep a scrapbook?
Not that I know of, sir.
Oh, the case is perfectly plain, said I, leaning back in my chair and regarding the puzzled Hale with that cherubic expression of self-satisfaction, which I know is so annoying to him.
"What's perfectly plain?" he demanded, more gruffly, perhaps, than etiquette would have sanctioned.
"Summertrees is no coiner, nor is he linked with any band of coiners.
What is he, then?"
"Ah, that opens another avenue of inquiry. For all I know to the contrary, he may be the most honest of men. On the surface, it would appear that he is a reasonably industrious tradesman in Tottenham Court Road, who is anxious that there should be no visible connection between a plebeian employment and so aristocratic a residence as that in Park Lane." At this point, Spencer Hale gave expression to one of those rare flashes of reason which are always an astonishment to his friends.
"That's nonsense, Monsieur Valmont," he said. "The man who is ashamed of the connection between his business and his house is one who is trying to get into society, or else the women of his family are trying it, as is usually the case. Now, Summertrees has no family. He himself goes nowhere, gives no entertainments, and accepts no invitations. He belongs to no club. Therefore, to say that he's ashamed of his connection with the Tottenham Court Road shop is absurd. He's concealing the connection for some other reason that will bear looking into."
My dear Hale, the goddess of wisdom herself could not have made a more sensible series of remarks.
Now, mon ami, do you want my assistance, or have you enough to go on with?
Enough to go on with? We have nothing more than we had when I called on you last night.
Last night, my dear Hale, you supposed this man was in league with coiners. Today you know he is not.
I know you say he's not.
I shrugged my shoulders and raised my eyebrows, smiling at him.
It is the same thing, Monsieur Hale.
Well, of all the conceited...
And the good Hale could get no further.
If you wish my assistance, it is yours.
Very good. Not to put too fine a point upon it, I do.
In that case, my dear Podgers, you will return to the residence of our friend Summertrees and get together for me in a bundle all of yesterday's morning and evening papers that were delivered to the house. Can you do that, or are they mixed up in a heap in the coal cellar?
I can do it, sir. I have instructions to place each day's papers in a pile by itself in case they should be wanted again. There is always 1 week's supply in the cellar, and we sell the papers of the week before to the ragmen.
Excellent. Well, take the risk of abstracting one day's journals and have them ready for me. I will call upon you at 3:30 exactly, and then I want you to take me upstairs to the clerk's bedroom in the third story, which I suppose is not locked during the daytime.
No, sir, it is not.
With this, the patient Podgers took his departure.
Spencer Hale rose when his assistant left.
Anything further I can do? He asked.
Yes. Give me the address of the shop in Tottenham Court Road.
Do you happen to have about you one of those new 5-shilling pieces which you believe to be illegally coined?
He opened his pocket-book, took out the bit of white metal, and handed it to me.
I'm going to pass this off before evening, I said, putting it in my pocket, and I hope none of your men will arrest me. That's all right, laughed Hale, as he took his leave. At 3:30, Podgers was waiting for me, and opened the front door as I came up the steps, thus saving me the necessity of ringing. The house seemed strangely quiet. The French cook was evidently down in the basement, and we had probably all the upper part to ourselves, unless Summertrees was in his study, which I doubted. Podgers led me directly upstairs to the clerk's room on the third floor, walking on tiptoe with an elephantine air of silence and secrecy combined, which struck me as unnecessary. "I will make an examination of this room," I said. "Kindly wait for me down by the door of the study." The bedroom proved to be of respectable size when one considers the smallness of the house. The bed was all nicely made up, and there were two chairs in the room, but the usual washstand and swing mirror were not visible. However, seeing a curtain at the farther end of the room, I drew it aside and found, as I expected, a fixed lavatory in an alcove of perhaps 4 feet deep by 5 in width. As the room was about 15 feet wide, this left 2/3 of the space unaccounted for. A moment later, I opened a door which exhibited a closet filled with clothes hanging on hooks. This left a space of 5 feet between the clothes closet and the lavatory. I thought at first that the entrance to the secret stairway must have issued from the lavatory, but examining the boards closely, although they sounded hollow to the knuckles, they were quite evidently plain matchboarding and not a concealed door. The entrance to the stairway, therefore, must issue from the clothes closet. The right-hand wall proved similar to the matchboarding of the lavatory as far as the casual eye or touch was concerned, but I saw at once it was a door. The latch turned out to be somewhat ingeniously operated by one of the hooks which held a pair of old trousers. I found that the hook, if pressed upward, allowed the door to swing outward over the stairhead. Descending to the second floor, a similar latch let me into a similar clothes closet in the room beneath. The two rooms were identical in size, one directly above the other, the only difference being that the lower room door gave into the study instead of into the hall, as was the case with the upper chamber. The study was extremely neat, either not much used or the abode of a very methodical man. There was nothing on the table except a pile of that morning's papers. I walked to the farther end, turned the key in the lock, and came out upon the astonished Podgers.
"Well, I'm blowed!" exclaimed he.
"Quite so," I rejoined. "You've been tiptoeing past an empty room for the last 2 weeks. Now, if you'll come with me, Podgers, I'll show you how the trick is done." When he entered the study, I locked the door once more and led the assumed butler, still tiptoeing through force of habit, up the stair into the top bedroom, and so out again, leaving everything exactly as we found it. We went down the main stair to the front hall, and there Podgers had my parcel of papers all neatly wrapped up. This bundle I carried to my flat, gave one of my assistants some instructions, and left him at work on the papers.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.